nodded in thanks as he sat down.
I was glad to see you calling out the need for the Jedi to be involved in your report. I know some folks don't like working with them.
They're a valuable resource for the Republic, the director replied. We just have to learn to use them properly.
They offered to have Master Nos D'Aral join our team.
A good choice, the director said, recalling the files the Order had sent over to the SIS. Darth Carrad was Nos D'Aral's apprentice before she decided to study under Malgus.
I don't think they'd phrase it like that,
Jace told him with a wry smile.
They'd probably say she fell to the temptations of the dark side.
Marcus frowned.
You think the Jedi are sending Nos D'Aral so he can try to redeem her?
Nos D'Aral's a pragmatist,
Jace assured him.
Well, as much as any Jedi can be. He won't do anything that might endanger the mission.
When Marcus didn't reply right away, Jace asked,
Is this going to be a problem for your people?
No, sir. Every name on that list I gave you is a professional. Whichever one of my agents you select for the mission will work alongside Nos D'Aral without complaint.
Actually,
Jace said,
I wanted to talk to you about that list.
For some reason, the hairs on the back of Marcus's neck stood up.
The files were all very impressive, but why wasn't Theron Shan among them?
For a moment, the director was too stunned to reply. SIS kept the identities of their field agents under close wraps. For security reasons, only a handful of people had access to department personnel records, and the Supreme Commander wasn't one of them. The director had given him a list of 6 agents who might be suitable for Operation Endgame, but that list didn't include Theron.
You know Theron?
He asked, wondering where the Supreme Commander had come up with the name.
Only from the analytics report,
Jace admitted.
He was listed as the agent who uncovered Darth Mekus's research.
The director shook his head, confused. He'd reviewed the report before it was sent to Jace. Theron's name had been redacted from the files. He was certain of it. Someone in analytics must have altered the final report before forwarding it to Jace. And Marcus had a pretty good idea who the culprit was.
No wonder Theron was so happy to be working on this report,
the director thought, gritting his teeth as he felt one of his migraines threatening to come on. Jace picked up on the director's discomfort.
Is something wrong? Is Theron Shan no longer with SIS?
Marcus thought about lying, but he didn't want to risk damaging his relationship with the Supreme Commander if the truth ever came to light.
Theron's still with us.
Is he a good agent?
One of our best, the director admitted. But every agent on the list I gave you is just as capable.
If Theron Shan started this, don't you think he's earned the right to see it through?
Theron may not be the best candidate for this particular mission, Marcus replied. This is a joint operation with the Jedi. He works best on his own.
The report says he was working with a Jedi when he went after Darth Mekus. Someone named Negani Zhou.
That was a unique situation.
Jace arched the eyebrow on the good side of his face in surprise.
You don't think Operation Endgame is a unique situation?
Theron's methods can sometimes be a bit too stylish,
Marcus explained, choosing his words carefully.
Stylish?
He prefers to go through the window instead of a perfectly good door.
I know the type,
Jace said, nodding.
More than a few of them in the military. Get addicted to the adrenaline rush. Always looking for action. Makes them trigger happy. They get too fond of killing and bloodshed.
Theron's not like that,
the director assured him, unwilling to sully his agent's reputation, even if he did feel like tossing Theron into a trash compactor at the moment.
You're obviously concerned about something,
Jace continued.
Are you worried he might betray us?
His loyalty to the Republic is absolute,
the director said emphatically.
He's just unfocused. He sees something that doesn't sit right with him, and he has to get involved, even if it's not part of the mission. He likes to improvise instead of sticking to plans.
Sounds to me like he's just going above and beyond, the Supreme Commander said. We could use someone like that for this mission.
Realizing the argument was already lost, the director held back a sigh as he asked,
Do you want me to send over his file?
I doubt there's anything in there you can't tell me now.
What do you want to know?
His name is Shan. Any relation to the Jedi Grand Master?
Shan is a very common name. Probably 10 million of them on Coruscant alone.
You didn't answer my question,
Jace said, fixing Marcus with a piercing stare.
Farron's her son,
Marcus admitted. Jace blinked in surprise.
Satil Shan had a son?
Only a handful of people know, Marcus explained. Obviously, this is something we want to keep under wraps. The Jedi aren't supposed to have children.
Who's the father? Another Jedi?
I don't know. I don't think even Farron knows.
The Supreme Commander was quiet for a few moments.
I'm guessing Farron isn't attuned to the Force,
he said at last.
Otherwise, he'd be in the Order instead of SIS.
True.
But this could still be good for the mission,
Jace said, speaking quickly.
Working with Jedi isn't easy. His relationship with Satil might make it easier to coordinate our efforts with the Order.
Farron doesn't really have a relationship with Satil,
the director cautioned.
She gave him up at birth. I don't even know if they've ever met.
I see,
Jace said, furrowing his brow.
Seems odd he wouldn't want to get to know her, given that they both serve the Republic.
Farron's relationship with the Jedi is complicated,
the director explained.
He was raised in secret by Master Nagani Zhou, Satil's mentor. Taught him everything the young Padawans learn at the Academy. Mental discipline, Jedi philosophy. I guess Zhou just assumed he would follow in Satil's footsteps when he got older. But the Jedi refused to take him. Turns out he wasn't sensitive to the Force.
He took after his father,
Jace muttered.
Probably,
Marcus agreed.
Kind of made Farron rethink all those lessons he learned as a kid.
Do you think he harbors any resentment toward the Jedi because they rejected him?
He respects what the Jedi do for the Republic,
Marcus replied.
But he's seen firsthand that they're not perfect. Made him a bit cynical when it comes to some of their more strongly held beliefs.
There was a long silence as the Supreme Commander weighed this new information.
I want him for this mission,
Jace suddenly declared, thumping his hand on the top of his desk for emphasis.
I served with Satil Shan during the war. If Farron has any of his mother in him, he's the perfect man for this job.
Farron's good,
the director said, making a final half-hearted effort to change the Supreme Commander's mind.
But I really think we'd be better off going with one of the agents from my original list.
Jace shook his head.
Farron's the one.
Yes, sir,
the director replied, though his response lacked any real enthusiasm.
I'll send his file so you can look it over, and I'll let Farron know.
Don't be so glum, Marcus,
Jace said with a grin.
I've got a gut feeling about this kid, and I've learned to trust my gut.
Chapter 11 Minister Davidge, the Imperial Minister of Logistics, tapped at the console of his computer, flipping through screen after screen of numbers arranged in columns, tables, graphs, and charts. The entirety of the Empire was represented in those numbers. Every citizen, every soldier, every subjugate, and every slave on every world. Every ship in every fleet, as well as all the resources produced across all the systems and sectors under Imperial control, was accounted for in mind-numbing detail and accuracy. The totalitarian rule of the emperor had led to a very efficient and organized system of inventories and censuses that measured everything under his control. And though he was gone, much to Minister Davidge's relief, the bureaucratic network he'd installed still remained. The screens and screens of numbers were the lifeblood Davidge needed. Without accurate, up-to-date data, he couldn't do his job. And in his mind, it was clearly the most important job in the Empire. Logistics, on a meta-scale, were the be-all and end-all of the Empire's survival. Resources and manpower dictated supplies and labor, which dictated the potential production and expected consumption of everything. Without him, the Empire had no plan to guide its course. Without him, the Minister of War wouldn't know how many ships or troops to send to each sector, or which worlds were worth fighting for, and which weren't worth the resources to defend. Even the Dark Council's members relied on him to give them a sense of the relative strength of the Empire compared to the Republic. Unfortunately, the Minister lacked hard numbers on the Republic. Ever since the collapse of Imperial Intelligence, data on the enemy had come from estimates, assumptions, and guesswork. It added variance to his equations, and Minister Davidge hated variance. It required him to provide predictions for both high and low ends of the spectrum, doubling his workload as he offered up predictive models, tracking the ebb and flow of the Galactic War. Even using the lowest estimates of Republic resources, the truth was inescapable. The tide had turned against the Empire, and if something didn't radically change over the next few years, their defeat was inevitable. It was simple math. The Minister finished up his final review of the data, gathered his report, and stood from his desk, stretching to loosen his cramped and tired muscles. He'd been huddled over the chair for nearly 12 hours, but Darth Maar had presented him with a question, and Davidge needed to be sure of the answer before he replied. Confident in his analysis, he turned and headed to the locked Durasteel door in the back of his office. He punched in the 16-digit code to unlock it, stepped inside, and sealed the door behind him. He moved quickly over to the communications console in the center of the room and activated the black cipher to send out an encrypted message to Darth Maar. The Sith Lord answered immediately. Clearly, he'd been waiting for Davidge's call.
"My lord," the minister said, "I've reviewed the situation in the Boronal system as you commanded."
"I assumed as much when I saw your call,"
Maar answered, his voice calm and cold as the grave. Davidge suppressed an urge to shudder. He didn't like dealing with the Dark Council. The Sith Lords were strange creatures beyond his comprehension. They were driven by emotion and passion, rather than logic and careful analysis. They often relied on visions and prophecy gleaned through the Force, allowing some mystical, unquantifiable power to guide their actions, rather than the undeniable truth of numbers. And sometimes they stubbornly refused to believe what he tried to tell them, especially when he delivered news they didn't want to hear. Maar was better than some of the others. He didn't rage and scream at Davidge when he didn't get the answer he sought, like Ravage, and he didn't seem to be eviscerating the minister with his eyes like Mortis. Most important, Maar understood that the minister's projections were not guarantees. Unforeseen variables could alter the equation, rendering the minister's numbers obsolete. But there was still something unsettling about the icy calm with which Maar always addressed him.
"What is your analysis?"
Maar pressed, and Davidge realized the Sith had been waiting for him to give his report.
Given the estimated level of Republic-backed resistance and the growing tide of anti-imperial sentiment among the native population, we should abandon our campaign in the Boronal system."
"There are 3 habitable worlds in that system. Nearly 20 billion people."
"Yes, my lord. But none of the planets has the abundance of resources necessary to offset the losses we will inevitably sustain if we try to keep the population under Imperial control."
"What's the loss ratio?"
Extrapolated over 6 months, there is a net 0.2% reduction in total Imperial output if we let the system go.
And if we try to hold it?
Conservative estimates put the loss at 0.4%.
After a moment, he hastily added,
in the worst-case scenario, losses could hit 0.7%.
To some, the numbers might sound small, but Davidge knew Mar was wise enough to understand the incredible scope of even 0.02% of the Empire's total resources.
The cost is high, but the Boronal system is not the only place in the Empire threatening to break away from our control. Crushing this uprising will send a message to other systems.
Of course, my lord,
Davidge said, though silently he sighed. He understood Mar's reasoning. Expend extra resources on the Boronal system in the hope that it would offset future losses. But in the minister's experience, such a plan rarely worked. Anti-imperial sentiment would still rise up in other systems, fed and fueled by the Republic and their promises of liberation. They would never recoup the extra few tenths of a percent it would cost them to hold the system. In Davidge's mind, this is how the Empire would fall. Not in some epic battle, but by tiny margins bleeding away. A death of a million microscopic cuts. But he dared not argue with Darth Mar.
I will arrange to have one of our nearby fleets send reinforcements to the system,
the minister said.
I believe Darth Kerid is still in that sector. The Ascendant Spear's arrival should put a quick end to the uprising.
The minister fought back another sigh. He was all too familiar with Darth Kerid and her methods. Whenever the Ascendant Spear was brought into a conflict, casualties and collateral damage increased exponentially. There was no doubt in his mind that the loss ratio would now push toward the highest of his estimates. Against his better judgment, the minister decided to speak up.
I'm still trying to absorb the cost of Darth Kerid's intervention at Lerator. The loss of Gravis's fleet has negatively impacted our projections. In this case, it might be better if you ordered someone else to go.
Darth Kerid is a member of the Dark Council now. She does not take orders from me, or from you.
Forgive me, my lord. I meant no offense.
Choose your words more carefully when you contact Darth Kerid to request her assistance in this matter.
Davidge understood numbers better than people, but it was obvious what Mar was hoping to accomplish. It was well known that he had supported the Fallen's candidacy from the beginning, and having the Minister of Logistics personally petition Darth Kerid for aid in the Boronal system would further legitimize her new position. And persuading her to undertake a mission in a remote system would keep her and the Ascendant Spear away from the machinations of any other members of the Dark Council, who might be looking to recruit her allegiance, at least for a while. It wasn't the first time the minister had been forced to bow to the politics of the Dark Council. At least this time, the cost to the Empire was less than it had been on other occasions.
I understand, my lord. I will contact her at once.
Try to be convincing when you ask for her help,
Mar warned, before disconnecting the signal. From his reports, the minister knew every potentially significant detail about Boronal and the other worlds in the system. Their geography and climate, their citizens and culture, their resources and industry. And he knew exactly how he would present this proposal to Darth Kerid. He composed a brief message summarizing the situation, running it through the cipher before transmitting it to the Ascendant Spear with a highest priority ranking. Despite this, it took almost 30 minutes before he received her reply. The delay was troubling. It hinted that the Fallen, like so many other of the high-ranking Sith lords, had little regard for the crucial role the Minister of Logistics played in the ongoing galactic war. Pushing his fears aside, Minister Davidge answered the incoming holo. Darth Kerid's face materialized before him. Each time he saw her, Davidge couldn't help but notice her marred beauty. Her perfect skin had been disfigured by the tattoos on her face that represented her devotion to the ways of the Sith. The cybernetic implants dominating her left side transformed her features into a grotesque mix of flesh and steel.
I received your message, Minister Davidge,
Darth Carrot said, her tone somewhere between annoyance and contempt.
Is this foolishness on Boronal really worthy of the Ascendant Spear?
No, it is not, Davidge thought. But Mar wants you there.
Out loud, he said,
we have reports of a steady build-up of Republic ships in the region in conjunction with numerous accounts of growing anti-imperial sentiment among the locals. My projections show that if this potential uprising is not dealt with swiftly, it could have a ripple effect throughout the Empire.
She twisted her face up in a sneer.
And what made you think this insignificant system was important enough to trouble a member of the Dark Council?
Knowing Mar would be displeased if Carrot discovered his involvement, the minister instead went with a carefully fabricated justification for contacting her.
There is a hypermatter research station on Boronal,
Davidge told her. There was some truth to his statement. There was an old hypermatter research station on Boronal, the largest and most heavily populated planet in the similarly named system. But he omitted the fact that it was a useless government boondoggle, put in place generations ago by corrupt politicians taking payouts from the wealthy family that owned the research company. The archaic equipment had fallen into disrepair, and the technicians supposedly working there were mostly relatives of influential nobles with no proper training.
Since you are now overseeing the technology sphere of influence,
Davidge continued, blatantly appealing to her ego,
I thought you might want to handle this personally. We can't let the research station fall under Republic control.
Carrot favored him with a coy smile, an expression that at the height of her beauty would have made Davidge's knees buckle with yearning and desire. Now, however, her gruesome visage merely churned his stomach.
Perhaps Mar is right about you. Maybe you are of some use to the Empire, after all.
Davidge remained silent.
You're in luck, Minister,
she said after a brief moment of contemplation.
I will set a course for the Boronal system and put an end to the flickers of rebellion.
I thank you on behalf of the Empire,
Davidge replied. Kara didn't bother to reply as she terminated the call. Relieved, the minister turned off the cipher, rose from his seat, and walked out of the communications room. He closed the Durasteel door behind him, waiting for the single beep that confirmed it was locked, and the cipher beyond was secure. Then he returned to his desk and went back to studying his tables, charts, and graphs. Chapter 12 Theron had no intention of showing up late for his briefing with the Supreme Commander. The Director was already furious with him for slipping his name into the summary report for Operation Endgame. No sense adding fuel to the fire. As a result, he arrived at Jace's office 20 minutes early.
Take a seat,
the receptionist instructed, pointing to one of several chairs against the wall.
The Supreme Commander will see you once everyone is here.
There was nothing in her tone to indicate this was anything but standard protocol, but Theron couldn't help but wonder if the Director had given explicit instructions not to let him in to speak with Jace Malcolm unescorted. However, looking at the young woman's bearing, professional but in no way wary or guarded, convinced him he was just being paranoid. He smiled to himself as he sat down, glad to see his survival skills were operating at full throttle once again. For a field agent, a little paranoia was a good thing. Sometimes they really were out to get you. The Director arrived about 15 minutes later. He gave a perfunctory nod to Theron, then a warm smile and wink to the receptionist. The young woman blushed and smiled herself as she pretended not to have seen the gesture.
Looks like the Director is looking for wife number 3,
Theron thought to himself.
Any advice for this meeting?
Theron asked quietly as his boss took a seat beside him to wait.
Since when does anything I ever tell you matter?
He replied in a sharp whisper, just low enough to keep the receptionist from hearing.
You just do whatever you want anyway.
But I get results,
Theron reminded him.
That's why you keep me around.
The director didn't reply, and Theron could tell he was biting his tongue to keep from unleashing a full-blown rant in front of the receptionist.
Jace is a military man,
the director finally said after regaining his composure.
He likes discipline and order. Pull one of your typical reckless stunts while he's calling the shots, and he'll crush you.
I'll keep that in mind,
Theron promised. They passed the next few minutes in uncomfortable silence until Master Nos D'Aurel, their Jedi liaison, arrived. The Keldor was slightly taller than Theron, though he appeared thinner, possibly because of his loose-fitting Jedi robe. His rough, ridged skin was a faded hue of yellow-brown. Like all Keldor who ventured from the helium-rich atmosphere of their homeworld, his eyes were protected by form-fitting goggles, and the lower half of his face was partially obscured by a steel breathing mask. The mask covered the fleshy chasm that Keldor possessed in place of a nose and mouth, though it left his 10-centimeter-long, downward-protruding tusks exposed. Given his complexion, the mask, the tusks, and the odd-shaped cranium typical of the species, Master Nos D'Aurel's appearance was intimidating and unsettling. But Theron knew the Jedi was one of the most respected and honored masters in the Order. He was the Republic's foremost expert on the Sith. He had studied them in detail for many years in his role as Keeper of the Jedi Archives. Having reviewed the file the Jedi sent over, however, Theron knew he was more than a mere historian. Nos D'Aurel was also an accomplished warrior. He'd been battling the Sith ever since their startling reemergence on the galactic stage, longer than Theron had even been alive. Theron wondered what the Keldor thought of Grandmaster Satil Shan. Though there were no records of them serving directly together, he surely knew the head of the Jedi Order personally. He also wondered if Nos D'Aurel knew Satil was his mother. Not that Theron really cared either way. Satil's connection to him was purely biological. His lineage had no bearing on who he was or what he had become. The only real parent he'd had was Master Zhou.
"Greetings, Director,"
the alien said, his voice deep and resonant even through his mask.
"And to you, Agent Shan."
"Call me Theron."
"As you wish. I knew Master Zhou. He spoke of you often. I grieved when I heard of his loss, though I take solace knowing he became one with the Force."
Theron was familiar enough with Jedi philosophy not to take offense at the well-intentioned words. He also made note of the fact that Nos D'Aurel mentioned Zhou, but not Satil, though he might just have been exercising discretion.
"The Supreme Commander will see you now,"
the young woman said, pressing a button behind her desk that caused the door to swing open. The three men rose as one and entered the room where Jace was waiting. The Supreme Commander sprang to his feet as they entered, coming over quickly to close the door behind them.
"Director, Master Nos D'Aurel," he said, nodding at each of them in turn. "Good to finally meet you, Theron."
His words came quickly, as if he was nervous. Theron chalked it up to excitement over the mission.
"I want everyone to speak freely," Malcolm continued. "Rank means nothing here. We're all equals in this meeting. If you have something to say, just say it."
"Think you can handle that, Theron?"
the director asked sarcastically.
"I'll try to get over my natural shyness."
"Perhaps we should bring each other up to speed,"
Master Nos D'Aurel suggested.
"You can tell me more about Operation Endgame, and I can tell you about the Ascendant Spears commander. She was once my Padawan, though she went by the name of Kana Tirid back then."
"I helped put together the analytics report," Theron reminded them. "I've studied everything that was in the files in detail. I'm more interested in what wasn't in the files."
The Jedi nodded.
"Kana showed great promise during her training, though I was always wary of her ambition. She rarely limited herself to the tasks I set to her. She liked to go off on her own, take risks, always looking for the next new challenge."
"Sounds familiar,"
the director mumbled, but Theron ignored him.
Instead of trying to change her nature, I sought to guide and direct her natural curiosity. I encouraged her to explore and branch out.
That doesn't sound familiar, Theron interjected, arching an eyebrow in his boss's direction.
It may be my fault that she fell to the dark side. I thought her training had given her the discipline to keep her safe, but perhaps giving her so much freedom was a mistake.
Theron chimed in before the director could say anything.
Some people are just drawn to the dark side. Forcing her to follow a rigid set of rules might have made her abandon the Jedi Order even sooner.
She didn't abandon the Jedi Order. Not as you think. I wanted to get one of my people into the Sith. Someone to help bring them down from the inside. I was the one who sent her to study under Darth Malgus. I knew it was a risk. If she was discovered, she would suffer untold tortures and a gruesome, painful death. Even worse, I knew the temptation of the dark side would test her. Malgus was both powerful and charismatic.
Theron wasn't entirely sure the risk of falling to the dark side was worse than torture and death, but he managed to keep his mouth shut.
For several years, she worked undercover, studying at Malgus's feet while secretly relaying information back to me. Much of what we know about the Ascendant Spear came from her initial reports, and her information led to several key Republic victories.
Let me guess what happened next, Theron said. The intel kept flowing, but it became less valuable. The information was still accurate, but it wasn't as strategically important.
She became a double agent. She was feeding us insignificant scraps on the Empire's plans, while relaying critical Republic intel to Darth Malgus. Before she abandoned us, we learned that the ship's full potential can only be unlocked by those with a powerful connection to the Force,
the Jedi added.
But it also requires special cybernetic implants to interface with the control systems. It is this union of ship and Sith that makes the spear such a formidable weapon. I believe Malgus convinced my Padawan to submit to the surgery for the cybernetic implants so she could take command of the vessel. That was likely the final temptation that lured her over to the dark side.
The Keldor's insistence on finding some identifiable reason for Carid's betrayal didn't sit well with Theron.
You're not going on this mission to try to redeem your former Padawan, are you? I know you Jedi believe nobody is beyond redemption, but bringing down the spear is going to be hard enough already.
My actions unleashed Darth Carid on the galaxy. It is my responsibility to stop her. That is my only concern.
Theron nodded. Taking care of unfinished business was something he could understand.
In any event, Kana changed her name to Darth Carid, and I haven't had any contact with her since. Everything I know about her now comes to me from other sources, like SIS.
We've just learned that Darth Carid has recently been given a seat on the Dark Council,
the director chimed in.
This doesn't change anything, Jace insisted. It just means taking Carid and the spear down will have an even greater impact on the Empire. That's why Operation Endgame is so important.
After reviewing all the scenarios analytics offered, we realize we can't stop the spear unless we first get a saboteur on board,
the Supreme Commander told Nosterall.
The plan is to have Theron stow away on the ship while it's docked at an Imperial spaceport for crew leave.
The spear never stays in port for long, Theron added. Getting a saboteur on board requires preparation and planning. We'd have to know which spaceport Carid was heading for, so we could get there first to set everything up.
We do have a mole inside Imperial Fleet Communications, the director said. And she can divert copies of any messages being transmitted to or from the Ascendant Spear to us. But those messages are coded.
Then it won't do us any good, Theron noted. Unless we have a black cipher.
Hasn't acquiring a black cipher been a Republic priority for months?
Nosterall asked, impressing Theron with his knowledge of something that didn't fall under the Order's typical purview.
The Empire has taken every precaution to keep that from happening,
Jace replied.
On two occasions, we even salvaged a damaged cipher from the wreckage of an Imperial capital ship in the hope of repairing or reverse-engineering it. Unfortunately, the ciphers are designed with a self-destruct function. When a capital ship goes down, the ciphers automatically burn out their decryption cores. Without a functional core, the cipher is just a worthless metal box.
So how do you propose we acquire one? Asked Theron.
The Imperial Minister of Logistics uses one to communicate with capital ships across the galaxy,
the director explained.
It's in his office at the Orbital Defense Command Center on Zyost.
So, we need to break into one of the most heavily guarded buildings on one of the Empire's most critical and well-defended worlds and steal the cipher without setting off the self-destruct sequence?
The Jedi asked, making sure he was clear on the plan.
It's more complicated than that, Theron said. If a working cipher goes missing, the Empire will just reprogram all their codes.
Theron knew it wasn't as simple as he was making it sound. The black ciphers had been designed to prevent anyone from tampering with them. They couldn't be reprogrammed in the field. Changing the encryption codes would require the Empire to recall their capital ships so technicians could synchronize the changes on each vessel. It would be costly and time-consuming, but it was still a better option than letting the enemy listen in on their classified transmissions.
But the Empire won't go to the trouble and expense of changing the codes if they don't think the cipher is missing,
the director explained.
We need to break into the minister's office and swap the working cipher's core with one of the burned-out cores from the damaged ciphers we recovered. Make them think the one in the minister's office was somehow damaged, causing it to set off the self-destruct sequence.
Won't they be suspicious if the cipher is mysteriously damaged?
Not if they think it was damaged in a terrorist attack,
Theron chimed in.
Plenty of Imperial installations on other worlds have been targeted in the past. We switch the cores, then detonate some explosives inside the building. Make it look like local anti-Imperial separatists set off a blast that triggered the cipher's self-destruct sequence.
Could be heavy civilian casualties if we aren't careful.
We'll do everything we can to minimize collateral damage.
We'll need the architectural blueprints for the Orbital Defense Command Center, along with a list of all their security protocols. Does SIS have a contact on Zyost we can use?
We haven't been able to make any inroads into Zyost yet,
the director admitted.
I know someone who can help,
Theron said.
The freelancer I worked with before. The hard part is going to be convincing her to work with me again.
Even if Theron's friend helps us out,
the director cautioned,
we're still working on a good cover story to get onto Zyost without drawing attention.
I can take care of that.
Theron raised an eyebrow in surprise.
SIS aren't the only ones who need to infiltrate Imperial worlds.
Then it's settled, Theron said. So when do we leave?
He knew they could keep going over the mission backward and forward, hashing out every last detail, but he didn't see the point. Part of what made him a good agent was the ability to think on his feet. Any specifics they came up with now would be pure speculation. It was inevitable things would change during the actual mission, and over-planning would only make it harder to adapt and improvise.
Give me time to get our cover story in place. We can meet at my private hangar in 2 days. I'll send you the location.
I'm glad you're both eager to start, Jace said. But let's not rush into anything.
You wanted Theron on this op,
Marcus said, coming to his agent's defense.
I've learned that when he's ready to go, the best thing is to just get out of his way.
I can do that,
Jace vowed.
Gentlemen, Operation Endgame has officially begun. May luck and the Force be with you.
Realizing they had been dismissed, Theron, the director, and Nos D'Aurol filed out of the Supreme Commander's office and into the reception area outside.
You two go on ahead,
the director told them, casting a quick glance over at the receptionist as the office door closed behind them.
I need to speak with this young lady about some paperwork. Coordinating SIS resources with the military. Gotta make everything official.
Theron suspected that whatever the director wanted to talk about was decidedly unofficial, but he had enough tact not to say anything as he and Nosterol continued out into the hall alone.
I'm looking forward to working with you,
the Jedi said once they reached a branch in the hall where they would part ways.
And I can assure you that my feelings for my former Padawan won't interfere with our mission.
That's good to know, Theron said, thinking, if it comes down to it, will you be able to kill her, or will you hesitate?
I'll see you in 2 days,
Nosterol said, then turned and headed off in the other direction. As he watched him go, the personal holocom on Theron's belt started to beep. Curious, he answered the call. To his surprise, the Supreme Commander's face materialized before him.
Theron, I'd like to speak to you again before the mission. Alone, at my private residence.
Of course, sir, Theron said, too taken aback to think of anything else.
Good. I'll send you the address. Be there tomorrow night.
The call ended before Theron could ask any questions, leaving him wondering what the Supreme Commander of the Republic could possibly want to discuss. Chapter 13. Jace Malcolm shifted his position, unable to get comfortable on the couch in the living room of his modestly furnished apartment as he waited for Theron to arrive. The Supreme Commander wasn't normally so restless. During his military career, he'd spent many hours just sitting and waiting. A soldier's life was long stretches of boredom, broken up by brief interludes of intense action. He'd learned long ago how to stay calm and relaxed as the minutes ticked by. But this situation was unlike anything he'd ever dealt with before. When the buzzer at his door rang, he actually sprang to his feet and paused a moment to collect himself before opening the door.
Thanks for coming, Theron,
he said to the young man on the other side.
I'm not going to miss a meeting with the Supreme Commander, Theron replied.
This wasn't an order, Jace assured him. Just a request.
Coming from someone in your position, they're basically the same thing.
Jace nodded. He had been an officer in command of others for many years, but his recent promotion to Supreme Commander had taken things to a level he still wasn't quite used to.
Come in and sit down, he said. Please,
he added, hoping to make it seem like an invitation. Theron settled into one of the 2 chairs across from the couch. Jace couldn't help but notice his choice of seat, facing the door and the farthest position away from where anyone else could sit.
Nice place you have here, Commander. Kind of expected the walls to be covered with all your medals and commendations.
They clashed with the drapes, Jace explained. Can I get you something to drink? I've got a nice Alderaanian vintage if you like wine. Or Corellian Reserve, if you prefer brandy.
No thanks, sir.
How about some Mandalorian Krygi?
Always wanted to try the hard stuff, Theron said. Sure, I'll take a glass.
Jace made his way over to the liquor cabinet in the corner and poured them both a shot, then brought it over to his guest before taking a seat on the couch facing him. In the light of the apartment, he could see that Theron favored his mother's side. He could make out a few faint hints of Satil Shan in the younger man's features, though if he didn't know who his mother was, it wouldn't have been noticeable.
To the Republic? Theron asked, holding up his glass.
The Republic,
Jace agreed, and they both downed their drinks in a single gulp.
Theron coughed and sputtered for a few seconds, a common reaction in those tasting Krygi for the first time.
Want another?
Jace asked.
It'll grow on you.
I'm good,
Theron gasped, his face still red from choking on the first glass. They set their empty glasses on the coffee table between them, and an uncomfortable silence settled over the room. Jace knew Theron was waiting for him to speak, but he honestly didn't know where to begin.
I served with your mother, he finally said, on Alderaan. She was a remarkable woman.
He could see a change come over Theron's face. He was suddenly guarded and wary.
I figured you knew, he said. Is that why you picked me for this mission?
I've seen your service record, Theron. You've earned this.
You didn't answer my question.
I wondered if there was some of your mother in you,
Jace admitted.
I don't mean to be rude, Commander, but if you brought me here to ask about Satil, you're out of luck. I barely know her.
There was a shortness to Theron's reply. It wasn't exactly anger or bitterness, more like exasperation. As if he'd had or imagined this conversation so many times before that he was simply tired of it.
So you've never reached out to her? Or she to you?
Theron shrugged.
Never saw any reason. When I was born, she gave me up to dedicate herself to the Republic. I understand why she did it, and I respect her choice. I chose to serve the Republic too. That's why I joined SIS. Making her part of my life now would just complicate things for both of us. Make both of our jobs harder. I don't see the point.
You seem pretty sure of this,
Jace noted.
Nagani Jo helped me understand why Satil did what she did. I've come to terms with it. I've moved on.
But what about your father? Didn't you ever want to ask Satil about him?
Master Jo was my father. He raised me. Made me who I am.
The conversation wasn't going as well as Jace had hoped. He was dancing around the real issue and realized he was actually afraid. He'd faced death too many times to count, but here he was, too scared to tell Theron why he was really here. Taking a deep breath, the Supreme Commander decided it was time to charge into the breach.
Theron, I didn't know Satil had a son. I only found out a few days ago when I saw your name in the report and I asked the director if you were related.
Kind of wish he'd lied to you,
Theron grumbled.
Could have avoided this whole awkward chat.
Jace ignored him and pressed on, determined to get the truth out there.
He gave me your personnel file. I checked when you were born, confirming what I already suspected. Theron, I believe that I am your father.
There was a long silence before Theron finally spoke.
I already told you,
he said coldly.
Master Zhou was my father.
Theron, you have to believe that I had no idea. When Satil broke off our relationship, I thought it was because of the Jedi Order's ban against emotional attachments. I didn't realize she was pregnant.
Theron stood up suddenly.
Commander, I'm sorry she lied to you, but this is between you and her. You need to talk to Satil.
That's the last thing I need right now,
Jace replied.
She lied to me, hid you from me. I'm so mad I wouldn't even know what to say to her.
But she'd know what to say to you,
Theron said sympathetically.
The Jedi always have an explanation.
Exactly. I'm in no mood to hear her prattle on about peace and controlling your emotions. That's why I came to you.
I still don't know what you want from me,
Theron said, shaking his head.
Why tell me this?
Why?
Jace rose to his feet.
You're my son. Doesn't that mean anything to you?
No,
Theron snapped, taking a step back.
We're just strangers who happen to share a biological connection.
That's my point,
Jace insisted, resisting the urge to take a step forward.
We don't have to be strangers.
I don't need someone to take me fishing or teach me how to ride a hoverbike.
That's not what I meant,
Jace said, shaking his head in frustration.
I just want to get to know you better. Maybe we have more in common than you think.
Theron sighed and brought a hand up to rub his temples.
Your timing on this is really terrible, Commander,
he said.
I could have handled this better,
Jace admitted.
I just thought you had a right to know. I'm still trying to figure this all out.
Fair enough,
Theron said, his tone softening.
I've been dealing with Satil's decision my whole life, but you just found out. I guess it's going to take you some time to get a handle on it.
Jace stayed silent, sensing that Theron was heading somewhere.
I have a lot of respect and admiration for you and what you do, Theron told him. And maybe we do have a lot in common. We've both dedicated our lives to helping the Republic. Maybe when I get back from Zios, we can try to get to know each other better.
Don't worry, Jace assured him. We could take it slow.
If we were taking it slow, you wouldn't have dropped this bomb on our first visit.
Sorry about that, Jace said. I thought you deserved to know before the mission. Just in case.
The professional soldier in him realized how poorly he had handled the whole situation, though there wasn't much he could do about it now.
You and Master Nostaral are scheduled to leave tomorrow. Do you need me to postpone the mission for a few days while you process this?
Give me a little credit, Commander, Theron replied. I'm more worried about you. Knowing I'm your son might affect your judgment on Operation Endgame.
You don't get to be Supreme Commander unless you can put personal feelings aside for the greater good of the Republic, Jace replied.
Glad to hear it.
There was another long, uncomfortable silence before Theron finally said,
I should go. I still have some things to get ready before I leave.
Right, of course.
Jace escorted Theron to the door. Just before he left, the young man turned to him.
We can talk again when I get back.
Looking forward to it,
Jace answered with a smile. The door slid closed, and Jace slowly made his way back over to collapse onto the couch. His heart was pounding, and his body felt simultaneously wired and exhausted, the same reaction he had at the end of an intense battle. He closed his eyes to take a short nap, and slipped immediately off to sleep. A useful skill most soldiers quickly learned. Jace lay motionless with his eyes closed on his cot as consciousness slowly returned. Floating on a cloud of coal tow, he could hear the celebration taking place outside his tent. Havoc Squad had won a great victory today over the Empire. The Republic had been giving ground ever since the Sith had first reappeared and seized Korriban. Reclaiming Alderaan was a morale boost the troops desperately needed. The songs and laughter of the soldiers from outside the tent sounded as if they were coming from a great distance, muted by the drugs that numbed the pain of his disfigured face. The explosion from the grenade he'd clutched in his hand while tackling Darth Malgus had scarred him for life. But his desperate actions had saved Satil Shan's life, just as her unexpected arrival had saved him from execution at the hands of the Sith earlier in the battle.
How are you feeling?
A gentle voice cooed in his ear, and he opened his eyes to see Satil hovering over him.
Muddled, Jace said with a smile. Kolto's making me a bit woozy.
He could feel his burned skin stretching and cracking at the gesture, and he half expected Satil to recoil as he realized what a gruesome sight he must be. Instead, she returned his smile and reached out to place a soft hand on his bare arm. Her touch sent a shiver along the spine.
What are you doing here?
He asked her.
On Alderaan, I mean.
I had a vision,
she told him.
The Force showed me that you would need my help on Alderaan, and I petitioned the Council to send reinforcements.
Might have to rethink my opinion on that mystical mumbo-jumbo.
Jace teased her.
Those imps were about to make me a full head shorter before you arrived. Guess I owe you one.
After all the battles we fought together, I've stopped keeping track of who owes whom,
Satil told him.
You know I'll always be there for you, and I know you'll be there for me.
We make a good team,
Jace conceded.
They find Malgus's body yet?
Satil shook her head.
I'm starting to think he survived the battle.
You dropped a mountain on him.
Jace grunted in disbelief.
How could anyone survive that?
He's a powerful Sith Lord. It's possible he used the dark side to survive my final assault. But you should not let that detract from this moment. All of Alderaan is hailing you as a hero this night. If you're up to it, I can take you out to enjoy the celebrations.
I'd rather stay here in my tent, alone with you.
Satil tried to dismiss his comment with a laugh, but there was a nervousness in her reaction that Jace could sense even through the fading fugue of the painkillers in his system.
I'm serious, Satil,
he said.
You know how I feel about you. I've felt that way for years, ever since we first met.
That's the Golto talking,
she said, though she sounded unsure.
The Golto's just giving me the courage to say what I've felt this entire time,
Jace insisted, sitting up and clasping her hand between his.
Or maybe it's knowing I was only seconds away from death. Whatever the reason, I can't keep playing this game. I can't ignore what's in my heart,
he continued, the words coming in a rush, his mind suddenly focused and clear.
And I know you feel something for me, too.
Zatiel shook her head, but she didn't pull her hand away. I am a Jedi. We must unburden ourselves from emotion and passion to find peace.
What peace can you find when the galaxy is consumed by war?
Jace asked.
Instead of denying what we feel, we should embrace it. Together, we are greater than each of us alone. You can't deny it.
I'm a Jedi,
she repeated, though Jace could tell her resolve was weakening.
There have been Jedi who fell in love,
he said.
The Order pretends it never happens, but we both know that isn't true.
Satil was silent for several moments. When she spoke, her voice was little more than a whisper.
I feared this moment since we first met,
she told him.
She leaned in and gave Jace a gentle kiss on the lips, careful not to brush the exposed and tender flesh of his wounds.
Jace woke with a start, nearly spilling himself off his couch. He hadn't dreamed about Satil for years. He'd thought the memories and the pain they brought him had been boxed safely away. Speaking with Theron, speaking with his son, had reopened old wounds. Checking his watch, he saw nearly 2 hours had passed since Theron had left. That would explain the crick in his neck. The couch was fine for a brief power nap, but it was no place to spend the night. Grunting like a man decades older, he forced himself to his feet and staggered off to bed, wondering if his nights would now be haunted by the only woman he had ever loved. Back in his apartment, Theron couldn't stop pacing. The conversation with Jace, with your father, had affected him more than he wanted to admit. Logically, everything he'd said to Jace was true. Nagani Jo had raised him, and the only real connection he had shared with the Supreme Commander was some shared DNA. Emotionally, however, he couldn't simply brush the revelation off. It rekindled long-forgotten feelings of anger and betrayal toward his mother, feelings he thought he'd come to terms with long ago. But when it came to Jace, he wasn't sure what he felt. He wasn't angry. It wasn't fair to blame the Supreme Commander for what Satil had done. He wasn't feeling happy or excited or relieved. He'd never felt the need to know his biological father before. So it wasn't like some great void in his life had suddenly been filled. Yet even though he couldn't describe it, he was feeling something.
You're not going to figure this out in one night.
Theron stopped pacing and shook his head, trying to regain his focus. Operation Endgame had to be his top priority. He couldn't afford to be distracted by this unexpected family drama. He had to put all thoughts of his parents aside and concentrate on the mission. He took a few deep breaths to regain his composure, a simple trick he'd learned from Nagani Jo.
Your real father.
Ignoring the voice inside his head, he made his way over to the holo terminal in the center of the room. He'd set up his apartment so that all incoming holo calls were automatically tracked and traced. He pulled up the data from his last call, Tefith, and sent off a hailing signal, not bothering to hide the identity tag on the transmission.
If she's dead set on not talking to me, she'll just ignore the call.
The hollow beeped several times before Tepeth finally answered.
Told you to leave us alone,
she snarled as her image materialized before him.
You didn't have to pick up.
Beeping hollow's annoying. What you want?
I need a favor.
Theron half expected her to cut the call short right there. Instead, she gave an exasperated sigh.
Knew you were following us for a reason.
It's a small favor, Theron assured her. Just need you to make one call.
To who?
She asked, her eyes narrowing suspiciously. Theron took it as a good sign that she hadn't said no.
I have some business on Xyost. I need a contact there who can hold on to an important package for a few days until I come to pick it up. Might also need him to get me a few things. Blueprints, information, maybe some explosives. You know anyone like that?
Thought you said you weren't following us on Xyost.
Theron held up his hands defensively.
Never set foot on that planet in my life. I only know you were there because you mentioned it on our last call.
Tepeth's headtails twitched as she debated whether to believe him or not.
What is about?
Can't say. Top secret. But it won't cause any problems for you or the old Tian Brotherhood.
Cause problems for the Empire?
Theron shrugged.
Does that really matter to you?
Got a contact who works with the ZLF. Maybe could do it.
Theron had read several reports focusing on the Xyost Liberation Front, a radical separatist group that had vowed to free their homeworld from Imperial control. Relying primarily on violent guerrilla attacks, they targeted both military and civilian targets, making them technically a terrorist organization. The ZLF was too extreme for the Republic to officially support them, but for this mission, they were exactly what he needed.
And you won't have to worry about any of them being sympathetic to the Empire. That should work, Theron said. Can you set up a meeting?
Never said we'd help you yet. Got to work out the terms.
200 credits.
1,000.
I'm not giving you 1,000 credits just to set up a meeting,
Theron said with a laugh.
300. Take it or leave it.
Tepeth chewed her lip for a minute as she considered the offer.
400 in advance, and this makes us even for Nar Shaddaa.
Before Theron could agree, she quickly added,
We set this up, and you leave us alone from now on. We see you following us again, we kill you.
Figured that would be part of the deal. 400 credits in advance, and you'll never see me again.
Satisfied, Tepeth said,
Okay, we set it up.
Chapter 14 Theron was impressed with the ship Nostoral had procured for their journey to Xyost. The TZ-6 executive shuttle was one of Corellian Engineering Corporation's most luxurious mass production vessels. The ship was easily worth 5 times the value of any craft Theron had ever owned. The name stenciled on the side, Prosperity, seemed particularly apt.
The Jedi must pay better than I thought,
he said, running an appreciative hand along the gleaming hull.
I'll be playing the part of a wealthy industrialist,
Nostoral explained.
It would look unusual if we were traveling in a substandard vessel.
Hey, you don't need to convince me, Theron said. I like traveling in style.
Theron took 2 quick steps up the boarding ramp, eager to check out the interior, and just as eager to leave Coruscant behind. He knew from past experience that once the mission was underway, his mind would be too focused to keep brooding over the fact that Jace Malcolm was his father.
So tell me more about our cover story,
Theron said, settling into one of the 6 luxurious reclining passenger seats. The plush cushions momentarily gave way beneath his weight before reshaping themselves to perfectly conform to every contour of his body.
I will play the part of Astrelid, a wealthy noble who owns several factories in the Daedalus sector,
Nostoral explained. The Jedi chose to remain standing rather than join Theron in one of the adjacent seats.
You will be my security chief, looking to upgrade weapons and armor for my personal bodyguards. Xyost has a thriving black market for both. Everything on board our ship will support this story, just in case customs officials decide to conduct a random search of the vessel.
What if someone gets suspicious and digs into our backstory?
Theron asked, reluctantly getting to his feet and leaving the comfort of the passenger chair behind.
My people have seeded the various databases the Empire has access to with documents that will support our story. Short of someone actually traveling to the Daedalus sector to investigate the factories in person, our story will hold up.
You've got quite the little operation going,
Theron said appreciatively.
For a Jedi historian, you make a pretty good spy.
As I said before, SIS are not the only ones gathering intelligence on our enemy.
Nostaral reminded him, following close behind as Theron headed for the cockpit.
But your efforts are focused primarily on the military and day-to-day operations of the Empire. My people are more interested in those who follow the dark side of the Force. The Sith Lords, the Dark Council, and even the Emperor.
I heard the Emperor's dead,
Theron noted, taking a seat in the co-pilot's chair.
That is what many believe,
Nostaral said cryptically, settling into the pilot's chair beside him.
You don't buy that?
Theron was pleased to discover that, like the passenger seats in the rear of the shuttle, the chairs in the cockpit adjusted themselves to provide maximum comfort and support. That would come in handy for the long flight to Zyost.
There are many possibilities I have not yet ruled out. The Emperor may be dead. He may be in hiding, or he may never have existed at all. At least not in any true sense of the word.
Haven't heard that one before,
Theron admitted.
There is some evidence to support the theory that the thousand-year-old Sith Emperor was merely a myth,
Nostaral explained, while going through a standard pre-flight check of their vessel.
It's possible that the Emperor is really just the strongest member of the Dark Council. When he or she dies, the next strongest secretly assumes that role, perpetuating the myth of an eternal, all-powerful being to keep the masses and other Sith Lords in line.
If that's the case, then why all the rumors that the Emperor is dead?
Theron asked, cross-checking the instruments and readouts.
Why hasn't one of them just stepped into his robes and made a quick public appearance?
The Dark Council, like the rest of the Empire, is in flux. There may be a disagreement among them as to who should be the next one to assume the Emperor's role. Or, the rumors could all be true, and the Emperor was actually an ancient being of unfathomable power who has recently disappeared, leaving his followers stumbling in his absence. Whatever the truth, I will one day find out. Knowledge is the key to stopping the Sith.
I thought taking out the Ascendant Spear was the key.
The Spear is the key to defeating the Empire and putting a quick end to the Galactic War,
Nostaral clarified, raising his voice to be heard as he fired up the ship's engines.
But the Sith are another matter entirely. Even if the Empire falls, the followers of the Dark Side will continue to exist in hiding. That is why I have devoted myself to studying the Sith. I am determined to find a way to cleanse the galaxy of their corrupting influence, putting an end to the eternal struggle between the light and dark sides of the Force.
Okay. Hope that works out for you.
Theron could feel the seat beneath him adjusting as the force of their liftoff pressed him into his chair. The Prosperity's thrust was impressive.
You mock me. Did Master Zhou not speak to you of the Force and the battle between the forces of light and darkness?
He was more interested in teaching me the skills I needed to survive. I think he was expecting the instructors at the Jedi Academy to fill me in on that kind of stuff. But when I didn't show an affinity for the Force, they refused to take me.
The Force manifests itself in many ways. It flows through all living things. Not being a Jedi doesn't diminish your worth.
Never said it did,
Theron answered, a little more sharply than he intended.
I need to input our destination into the nav computer,
Nostaral said, perhaps sensing it was time to put an end to the conversation. Theron was all too happy to let the matter drop. In his few weeks at the Academy, He'd experienced enough of the unintentional but unmistakable self-righteous superiority of the Jedi to last a lifetime.
Could have been worse, Theron thought. At least he didn't ask me about my mother.
Once again, Theron wondered if the Keldor knew about Satil's secret shame. The rest of the trip passed in relative silence, both men retreating to inner contemplation as they went through the mundane routines of deep space travel. Theron actually appreciated the lack of conversation. It gave him time to mentally prepare for the coming mission. By the time they were halfway to Xyost, he'd successfully banished all thoughts of Jace and Satil, leaving his mind clear and focused. The clearance procedures for ships approaching Xyost were far too regulated to actually be efficient, but they passed through the gauntlet of customs and security with little difficulty and were given permission to land. Once the Prosperity touched down, the faceless guards tasked with authorizing their presence on the Imperial-controlled world simply asked Nos D'Aurol a few routine questions, ran a quick verification of the ship's registration, and made a perfunctory search of the interior before waving them through. Safely out of earshot, Theron couldn't help but whisper,
"If we knew customs was just going to wave us through, we wouldn't have had to ship the decryption core here ahead of time."
"The Empire has ears everywhere."
Duly chastened, Theron decided to keep any further smart-mouthed comments to himself. As they made their way from the landing bay to a speeder waiting outside the spaceport to take them to Tefet's contact, Theron couldn't help but marvel at the cosmopolitan feel of the crowd. He counted at least a dozen different species from every corner of the galaxy, including sectors where countless Republic soldiers had given their lives to save the local populations from being conquered and enslaved by the Sith. The scene was even more difficult to fathom when one considered Xyost's history. The Sith had fled here over 20,000 years ago, when a war of succession reduced Korriban to an uninhabitable wasteland. They adopted Xyost as their new homeworld, and at one time, it had even served as the capital of the Sith Empire. No one from the Republic had ever even officially set foot on Xyost. Since its founding, it had remained under the absolute control of the xenophobic Sith Empire. Even as recently as a decade ago, the only non-human, non-Sith purebloods on the world would have been slaves in chains or cages. Now, however, the planet had been reinvented as the gateway to the Empire, the place where anyone seeking an alternative to dealing with the Republic was welcome to come and do business with the Sith. While some might see Xyost's newfound openness as proof the Empire had become more tolerant and accepting, Theron wasn't fooled. The Imperials were losing the war. They were desperate. So desperate, they were willing to swallow their bigotry to welcome the so-called lesser species with open arms. At least on this one planet. Theron's thoughts were interrupted by a subtle nudge from Nos D'Aurol. The Jedi Master was looking up at a nearby holoscreen running an official news report. The images primarily showed the mangled wreckage of several medium-sized Republic ships, the kind used in hit-and-run attacks on Imperial fleets. The voice of an Imperial shill played over the images of death and destruction.
"A recent attempt by the Republic and anti-Imperial separatists to conquer the loyal citizens of the Boronol system was easily repulsed by the might of the Imperial defenders."
One shot in particular grabbed Theron's attention. Two halves of a Republic vessel floating side by side. The hull split cleanly between bow and stern, like a giant saw had sliced it through. He knew of only one ship in the galaxy with laser cannons powerful enough to inflict that kind of damage. The images changed to show several city blocks on the planetary surface that had been leveled by an orbital bombardment. Most of the buildings were reduced to rubble. Those few that still stood had huge chunks torn away to expose the bent and twisted durasteel beams that supported their frames. The streets were impassable, choked with debris and the bodies of innocent civilians.
"Before the arrival of their Imperial saviors, the citizens of Boronol were subjected to a cowardly assault from the Republic fleet orbiting their world."
Theron couldn't help but shake his head in denial at the blatant Imperial propaganda. Orbital bombardment of civilians wasn't something the Republic practiced. and none of the vanquished Republic ships they'd shown had the firepower to wreak that kind of havoc. The more likely explanation was that the spear had wiped out the Republic ships, then turned its guns on Borinol. Whether Carrot was eliminating resistance on the ground or simply punishing the planet for daring to harbor anti-imperial separatists didn't matter to Theron. There was no excuse for the kind of slaughter she'd unleashed. He saw Nos D'Aurol stiffen, and he realized the Jedi Master had come to the same conclusions he had. Theron hoped seeing the horrors his former apprentice was capable of might convince Nos D'Aurol to abandon his hope that she could be redeemed. Though he knew enough about Jedi in general to realize this probably wouldn't change anything. The two men continued in silence through the spaceport to where Nos D'Aurol had arranged to have a speeder waiting for them. Stepping outside, Theron was struck by a cold blast of wind. Shivering, he pulled his cloak tighter around his body. The air was dry and gritty, with tiny particles of dirt and dust swept along by the breeze. And he squinted, wishing he had a cover for his face. The Keldor, with his goggles and breathing mask, didn't seem bothered by the harsh wind, though Theron took some small satisfaction in seeing him also shivering from the cold. Fortunately, their speeder was as luxurious as their shuttle had been, with a sealed climate-controlled dome to shield them from the elements. Once again, Nos D'Aurol sat in the pilot's chair, and Theron took the seat beside him. Theron wasn't much of a follower, but he was happy to defer to his partner on the little things. They zipped through the bustling streets of Zios Market District, their speeder whisking them above the crowds. There were still several hours of daylight, and Theron was clearly able to see the people below them in the light of the world's distant and faded orange sun. Although he only got a brief view from above, the market district had the same vibrant cosmopolitan feel as the spaceport. As soon as they passed into the neighboring residential district, however, everything changed. It was still crowded. Zios was a heavily populated metropolis, but the life and color seemed to vanish in an instant. Everything was drab and gray. The buildings, the streets, and even the clothes of the people in the crowd.
You can feel the oppression of this place. The hopeless despair of the entire city.
Theron nodded, knowing the Jedi wasn't referring to something he sensed through the Force. Under Imperial rule, there were harsh penalties for even minor infractions, and it wasn't hard to see the impact. Unlike the chaos of Nar Shaddaa, here there was an orderly, almost rigid flow of traffic, both on the ground and in the air. Pedestrians moved with brisk purpose, heads down, eager to get off the street and back to the anonymous safety of their homes. Speeders stayed in their designated lanes, and nobody dared to go faster than the posted limit. Swoop bikes were nowhere to be found, and if there were gangs on Zios, Theron imagined they'd be careful to stay well hidden. It made for good Imperial propaganda. They claimed their worlds were free of all petty crime. But Theron would gladly take a few pickpockets and some graffiti over a sterile, lifeless existence under a completely totalitarian government.
We are almost there,
Nos D'Aurol informed him, as they left the residential district and passed into an industrial area, populated by square, windowless warehouses.
I hope your friend's contact comes through for us.
Me too.
He brought the speeder down just outside the door of one of the buildings. To Theron's eye, it looked exactly like every other structure on the street, but he trusted the Jedi to deliver them to the address Tefeth had provided. Bracing themselves against the bitter wind, they rushed from the speeder to the door. It opened as they reached it, and they hurried inside. Beyond the door was a small open-air office and reception area. Four desks were arranged around the room, though none of them was currently occupied. A single door on the far wall led into the warehouse at the back.
Good to get out of the cold, isn't it?
Their host said cheerfully. He was a middle-aged human. The crown of his bald head was surrounded by a ring of curly brown hair. His face was ruddy, his features plain. His loose-fitting clothes were unremarkable, but Theron could tell they had been selected partly to hide the man's flabby chest and protruding gut.
Unassuming and non-threatening. The perfect front man for a brutal group like the ZLF.
Name's Finn,
he said, thrusting out a meaty hand.
You must be Tefeth's friends.
Theron shook the man's hand, but didn't offer his name. Nostoral followed his lead.
Everything you sent ahead is here, safe and sound,
Vin said, getting right to business.
Got it all safely hidden away back in the warehouse. Even that burned-out computer core. Kinda curious as to what you need that for,
he added with a chuckle.
What did you find out about the Orbital Defense Command Center?
Theron said, not bothering to satisfy Vin's curiosity.
Got the architectural blueprints right here,
he said, pulling out a data pad.
And everything anyone could possibly want to know about the security systems they have in place.
He hesitated for a second, as if debating how much he was willing to share with these strangers based solely on Tefeth's referral.
You know,
he said, drawing the words out slowly,
if you're looking to cause trouble for the Empire, I have some friends who might be interested in lending a hand.
I bet you do, Theron thought. But if any of your ZLF brothers get captured, the Imperial interrogators will make them sing. Can't take that risk.
Out loud, he simply said,
we prefer to work alone.
Understood,
Vin said with a cheery nod.
Just putting it out there.
Theron took the datapad and briefly flicked through the contents.
Top-of-the-line system. Redundant fail-safes, he muttered. No surprise there. I'm probably going to need some extra high-tech equipment,
he continued without looking up.
If I put together a list, can you get me everything I need?
That'll cost extra,
their chubby host said apologetically.
We can pay, as long as you deliver the goods.
Vin's chest puffed up with pride.
Hardware and equipment is my specialty. If somebody manufactures it, I can find it. Could take a couple of days, though.
Until then, we should try to keep a low profile. Stay out of trouble.
You've been talking with the director,
Theron thought.
Don't worry, he said, holding up the data pad. I've got plenty to keep me busy.
Chapter 15. In keeping with his cover as a wealthy industrialist, Nostoral had rented them a two-bedroom suite on Zyost that was the height of luxury and comfort, nearly twice the size of Theron's apartment on Coruscant. It had taken a good hour to thoroughly sweep the place for bugs and recording devices. The bed in Theron's room was the most comfortable one he'd ever had the pleasure of sleeping in, but he was never able to get more than a few hours' rest while on a mission. By the time Nostoral emerged from his own quarters, Theron was already hunched over the counter of the breakfast nook, studying the information on the datapad Vin had given him.
You're up early.
I've been thinking about the mission, Theron said, eyes on the screen. I think we need more than a simple bombing to distract the Empire from what we're really up to.